Welcome to Polycast, the official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
Dan Quick,
Moses Snyders,
Imran Siddiqui,
and Mark Ulrich.
Guest co-hosts,
Matt Jane,
Barry Caudill,
Dorian Newcomb.
Here's the questions. All right, talk.
Hello, how's it going?
Talk.
I'm a producer. It's what I do.
Lawyer was actually kind enough to put together some additional questions that also include you, Dorian.
Thanks a lot. I know that we usually don't get a lot of press on, hey, how is the amazing artwork made? So it's always good to get a little bit of that because they're like, the gameplay is great. Can we talk about that? So anything that we can do to try to make everything good is awesome.
I never said Lawyer's questions were good, but.
There you go. Are you telling me you were jealous of not being on Polygon?
Not anymore.
Good answer.
It is just revolution with no S.
Thank you. If I had someone contact me and try to correct me, and I'm like, no, it's just revolution.
That's right. Catch the civolution. I don't know.
Ooh.
That's why I'm not in marketing.
Mary and Dorian, I'm mostly here for comedic whatever.
That's funny. That's why Dorian and I are here. So.
All right.
In the news, we learn about a Poulton's newly minted Civilization IV Beyond the Sword Tri-League Tournament, the next up-and-coming BTS patch, and one of the latest Civilization Revolution previews. In the Senate, the importance of the spy unit a la Beyond the Sword and considering keeping cultural characteristics in the research lab. Then the start of our extensive interview with Firaxis Games executive producer Barry Caudill and artist Dorian Newcomb. Questions on BTS. Over in the modcast, the worst corporation in Beyond the Sword and the worst unit in Civ 4, period, followed by reaction to a BTS change on how peace treaties operate. We then return to our chat with Barry and Dorian now with the first batch of Civ Rev inquiries. Finally, how to insert Civ 4 icons into chat messages in the mailbag.
The news?
News.
News.
So, Matt, tell us about this Tri-League tournament you and Rob are crazy enough to organize.
The Tri-League tournament has been set up to enable some comparative play between all the good folks here at Apollotron. What we've done is we've set up the league. There's three leagues within it. We've got novice, advanced, and intermediate. We're posting the games. The games are available to play for 30 days after they're up there. And we're hoping to get out about two games a month. We're looking at changing how we do things. We're looking at different victory settings on those games. So, for example, the first game is we're accepting any victory, which I think some of them in the advanced league are finding a little bit difficult. And then we may, in the second game, have stuff like we'll only accept a cultural victory or a space race victory, or we want to see a conquest victory by XAD, all that kind of stuff. Keep it mixed up and keep it interesting.
Were there any other names for the league that you were given, but decided to go with Tri-League anyway?
what was it? Iron League of Endurance or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had a couple of suggestions out there. Oh, we had all sorts of silly things to start off with. The name is reflecting the fact that it rotates around the three kind of set difficulty levels. We're just trying to make it as easy as possible for people to play so new players can jump on in. We've got some pretty cool prizes out there as well. Each game, the prizes are, there's a Poly Plus subscription, the length of which varies depending on which difficulty you're playing, and we've also got Hall of Fame votes as well, up for grabs.
And who provided those prizes?
Oh, you did, Dan.
Oh, gee, was it you, Dan?
You're the man.
Woo! You can stay.
Someone actually called Dan the man on this show.
Yeah, I know.
Uh-oh. It might go to his head.
Too late. I think it already did.
Forgive me. It's early. So at this point in time, we've got about 30 people playing in the league, which is not bad. It's only been open for about 5 days now.
Did you ever get any takers for novice?
We've just had our first for novice. Novice was the hardest one. it was a case of what do we call the novice league? Beginner sounds just as exciting.
Can't call it noob.
The dad league?
The dad cube.
Dangerous Dan's league, yeah.
The royalties were too high, and Matt had to abandon that idea.
We have had our first player sign up for it. Again, it's a case of what do you call it, but it's a good starting point for people to kind of benchmark themselves against everyone else in the league. It's going to be much easier to move up through the leagues than it is back through the leagues. Just from a point of view, we just don't want people moving backwards and just pawning the new players. In short, yes, we have had our first sign up for the Novice League.
Was it Dan? You've been emphasizing that the tournament is about good-natured competitive fun.
While it's competitive and while it's best save wins, it's also an opportunity once the game has closed for people to do a bit of comparative discussion, see what's worked well for some players on certain maps and what hasn't, chance for some of us to learn from others, and just good, clean fun. Well, as clean as it gets.
Cleaner than this show. And that was a very good answer, Matt, although you didn't wait for me to ask a question. I don't know what you think you're doing, but...
He's bypassing the middleman, Dan.
I've done a bit of media before. You don't necessarily wait for the question. Sorry.
So as far as competitive plays goes, how does it compare to Politan University? Because that's sort of doing the same thing.
Comparative play, from the league point of view, it's a case of best score wins. So it's comparative play initially from a who wins the game, who gets the prizes. Then afterwards, we will open up some threads to allow people, if they want to, the opportunity to ask, say, how did you get the whatever victory so early, or what tactic did you take with this issue, depending on how the maps are set up. The maps aren't set up specifically for people to learn, but there is that opportunity afterwards for them to do so if they wish to. Or, you know, you can just post in there and go, ha-ha, beat you. What do you want to do? So when are you guys signing up to play in the league?
I just did. Of course, I'm only playing a novice, but...
She's a novice. Uh-oh. Is there a pre-novice?
Well, I haven't gotten comfortable with Prince level yet, so I figured I'd see how well I do at Warlord.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things we're going to be looking at doing is, once we get a few more players involved, is we will be setting up almost like make-your-own-game kind of threads, so we can get people to choose within their own leagues what within a range, what difficulty they want to play on, what map style, just to try and keep it as interactive as possible.
We just mentioned that you got your first and now your second sign-up for Novice. Are most people, have they gone for the Intermediate League, I believe?
Yeah, Intermediate League is most definitely the popular league. That is where all the action is at the moment. However, we've now got about 5 signed up for the Advanced League, which is pretty cool. Mind you, we haven't received any saves back in from those folks yet, so we'll see how we go with that. There have been a couple of comments that the Advanced game is challenging.
Well, that's why it's the Advanced game.
In the forums about the new patch, it's a very long list and there's a lot of changes. Based on our previous discussion that we had last podcast, one of the changes they did was changed how Christo and Detour worked.
Yeah, it's got nerfed.
Yeah, The exploit has been reduced so that now you can only change it.
Yeah, once a turn.
So that dealt with a lot of our concerns about it.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest change in this patch, and it was sorely needed, as we discussed. So definitely a good thing there.
The list of changes came out after the episode was released, wasn't it? Coincidence? I think not.
They listened to us. They listened to us. And they felt ashamed. They felt ashamed. I feel ashamed listening to us. Let's see. What other changes have they done?
One thing that I really like is that inflation no longer increases after the game time limit has been reached. I like to play on sometimes even after 2000 BC or whenever the game ends, and it really quickly becomes unplayable, especially on Epic and Marathon, because the inflation is just through the roof.
Well, that's good. And the thing that impressed me about that is, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people don't play on beyond the game. I guess they've listened to people who have complained about it and said, you know what, for those who will, we're just going to do this minor thing. Shows to me that they're listening to their fans, even if it's not like huge cry for it or something like that, like it may have been for Christopher and Detour, which is nice.
We already knew that. they do listen a lot.
And one of the other big ones there is the espionage, poison, water, and happiness amounts no longer incorrectly scale with game speed, which will make us marathon players very, very happy.
Oh, that's right. That was a huge, huge thing.
It was okay if you were the one doing it, but when it happened to you, it hurt. It hurt a lot. They've also changed it so vassals can no longer use spies against their master, which is great.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Can no longer build forts in rival territory. I'm sorry, why would you do that?
Dan's like, no! A decent number of AI fixes here, tweaking the espionage stuff. Now they know how to use Steel Tech and Incite Revolt, and they use spies, as it says, more smartly.
But with the vassals no longer spying on their master, this seems to be just active missions, which is good to see. You should still be able to do passive things, especially if you're a vassal. The master wouldn't even think for a moment that a vassal would do such a horrible thing.
And since the AI is rather village-happy with their spies, it's nice to see that spies no longer destroy entire towns in one go, but just downgrade them to hamlets and then to villages, etc. Was a bit strong of an effect.
There's increased likelihood of AI stealing techs. That should be an interesting change. And the AI is more aggressive early in the game as well, even on non-aggressive AI. So that was something that some people at any rate had complained about, saying that unless you click aggressive AI, the AI isn't going to do anything.
Paratroopers have 25% invasion chance. Well, that's great if you use those darn things. Moving on. Oh, if an anonymous game is about to be launched with duplicate leaders, players are informed of which leader is duplicate. Oh, that's too bad. Oh, I'm the evil leader. I'm the good leader. Fixed bug where the Three Gorges Dam, which is spelled D-A-M-N.
All right. Good job.
The dam.
It's like Three Gorges Dam. Someone else built it before I did.
You've been watching my games.
Fixed bug where Three Gorges Dam would give power unhealthiness to all cities, and then in the next line, fixed bug where new cities would not get power unhealthiness from the Three Gorges Dam. Stupid Three Gorges Dam. Someone come raise my cities. I need to build some new ones. No, not the one with the Three Gorges Dam. Ah, damn it. Three Gorges Dam.
Ay, ay, ay.
Fixed bug where you could infiltrate your own city.
Do you see the Apostolic Palace can no longer vote to give a human a second city and a one city chaplain?
I'm not upgrading to this patch. This gets rid of all the fun.
I love it. In the bug fixes, one of them, it says fixed crash. That's it.
Okay.
Which crash?
Oh, I think this bug list also reveals something we didn't need to know. Fixed Lincoln eyeshadow using low-res textures. Lincoln's wearing eyeshadow now? What?
A fixed AI asking you to declare war on his vassal.
That would help.
Oh, Red Cross does not rotate in civil PD to show missing back.
There was not a whole lot wrong with the game, so there's not a whole lot to fix in the patches either.
It's very true.
Something you can always continue to refine. It's never perfect anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Two or three things that they really needed to be fixed. A lot of very small issues, but not really a major patch like 1.6.1 was for original Civ 4.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good thing, because it means the game was pretty good to begin with.
The one on IGN, the GC2000, whatever, about CivRev, where they talk about sending a spy to actually steal an enemy general and bring him over to their side. Because that's interesting. Oh, and apparently he completed his work at Oracle Delphi Wonder, which granted him knowledge of a nearby ancient artifact, the Ark of the Covenant. The ancient relics are very powerful items that should encourage a player to explore the world around them. The player who claims the Ark immediately gets free temples and cathedrals in all his existing cities. And that's actually one of the weaker artifacts in the game.
Sounds like game balance is going to be interesting for that game.
It does sound interesting, and I don't know, it sounds like it may be a little too powerful.
the best part of the CBG article is the comments area, actually. First comment is, nice to see more and more RTS being developed exclusively for consoles. Part of me is concerned that it will be watered down. I don't think it's going to be as complicated as Beyond the Sword for a number of years, but that doesn't mean it's going to be watered down. I'm not a fan of the cartoony looks, really. Though otherwise, graphically, it's looking really nice. Well, listen, that...
Go on in the same.
Yeah.
It seems like the Pro G talks about that the pace is similar to a typical first hour of traditional Civilization game. They say that for hardcore gamers, it's probably a little too basic. But for newcomers, it may feel a little too much entrenched in the Civilization world, which, I don't know, I'm not sure I see the problem there. I think that was the point, wasn't it? Oh, cool. The spy, accompanied by toy piano tiptoe music and mischievous animation. All right.
Got news. Email news at apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Snoopy369, Alexander I, or Luminatus via Apolton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
How important is the spy unit for you?
I use them occasionally. I think I would do that. I do it sometimes to harass and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, this is the third option about I hardly ever use them and mostly ignore the spies of the others. I hardly ever use them, but I don't mostly ignore the spies of the others.
Hmm.
You can't ignore spying completely. You have to dedicate part of your income.
Yeah, just for anti.
I usually write about 80% research and 20% spy.
I occasionally will use 10% for espionage, but usually I keep it at zero. I just build enough buildings. Get by with that, usually. Maybe on the higher difficulty levels, that's a bit harder to do, but only playing on Monarch, so...
Oh, yeah, so as the game progresses, you get more buildings. I would probably might even scale back in the later game because of those, but earlier on...
Politon University.
Oh, yeah, that's right, we do have that.
If people do want to learn how to play safe better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice. That's the Politon University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Politon.net.
Really?
Forums?
Wow, how could I figure that
out? I don't know.
Politon University. Sometimes I wonder.
Welcome to the Research Lab, where we explore game concepts or ideas that are not in Civilization yet, but they might be in the future.
New idea for Civ 5. This is from Bacles44. How about when you conquer a city from another Civ, it keeps its own cultural characteristics and special buildings and units. So if you spawn a settler from that city, it can settle a new city of its own culture, even though you control it.
Mm.
If something like this were implemented, I think it would add a whole new dimension to the game. Well, maybe late-game rebellions to assert independence from the occupier, even if the entire original Civ was conquered, for example.
They actually did something sort of like that with Master of Magic. It was fantasy games. There's different fantasy races, but you could control more than one, and you could make settlers of that same type from that city because they had different unique units you might want to mix in your army.
Oh.
And they had different relations to each other. So some of the races were better at controlling everyone else, but some of them just did not get along, and your cities would all, you'd have to build up a bunch of happiness in the cities. Otherwise, they would try and rebel on you.
Part 1 of our interview with Firaxis Games' Barry Cottle and Dorian Newcomb.
Is this really the first question? All right. Who are you and where are you from?
My name is Barry Cottle. I'm originally from Maryland, just north of Hutt Valley, where the company is located now.
And my name is Dorian Newcomb, from Maryland, went to school in New York for art at Pratt, and then I ended up coming back to Baltimore because I had no idea great games were made here.
Okay, cool. How did you guys come to work for Firaxis?
I was working at the Microprose studio where Sid originally came from, Sid and Jeff, and they had left to start Firaxis before I got there. And I was in QA for a while, and when Civ 3 was in test, I actually came over here and was on site for almost a year helping to test Civ 3, but I was working for Atari still. And right after that, they closed the department at Atari. There was no longer a QA department in Hutt Valley, and so I came over here and they made me the QA manager.
I'd been at a startup in Northern Virginia trying to put together a massively multiplayer RPG way back in the EverQuest days, and I went to GDC looking for a job, and I handed off my resume to two of the Firaxis artists, and they said, why didn't you just drive up? You're from the East Coast. Why did you come all the way to the West Coast to apply to us? When I went to Firaxis, they were working on Civ 3, and I was so excited to see a large game being developed by people that cared about it. I couldn't refuse the job offer.
Besides Civ, what games have each of you worked on?
Oh, my gosh. My list would be really long, because when I was at Atari, well, it was Hasbro Interactive, was the first one to buy Microprose, and then they became Infogrames, and then they became Atari. While I was there, I probably tested nearly 50 games. Everything from cool stuff, like I started on Civ 2 Multiplayer Gold, and I worked on Test of Time, you know, things like that. And I also worked on Majesty, which was a really fun game to test. I worked on, like, Pokemon, the Pokemon card game. Then I also worked on really terrible, nasty stuff like Candyland Adventures 2 and Chutes and Ladders. And then while here, I've worked on Civ 3, all the expansions, Civ 4 expansions, Pirates, and currently Revolution.
First experience I had was a really small strategy game called Semper Fi that I hope no one looks up. The great thing was I got a chance to work with a very small group of guys trying to figure out things out. It felt like for the first time. And then since I've been in Firaxis, I've had a chance to work on Civilization III, doing a lot of the unit work. I got a chance to do a little bit on Sim Golf. I got to work with Sid for about a month on Pirates when he started that. And I've had the luxury of working on Civ 4 and being the lead on Beyond the Sword. I have a lot of Civilization work since I've been here, but I sort of like it because you get to move through the eras so quickly. You know, you could be working on a Roman guy 1 week, and the next week you're working in a tank, and you can really sort of set what you want to do and your goals can be pretty different for each week that you come in.
So we know you're good at doing things like saying, make art. So what else does a game producer do?
I mostly just tell people to do so. The way that I always explain it is that it's a misnomer because we don't actually produce anything. That's the joke, you know. It's like, well, what do you produce? I produce more work for people and meetings. You know, I guess the truth of the matter is what a producer produces is the finished game. So it's mostly a matter of keeping track. Early on, you develop schedules based on estimates that people give you, how long it takes to do certain piece of art or piece of music or how long it takes to code a certain system. You know, the first big uh-oh moment is when you put that all together in Microsoft Project and find out that it goes 2 years past when you're supposed to deliver. Somewhere along the line, you have to figure out, well, if I add more people, I can do this, or if I take away this feature, then comes in, and eventually, you know, you deliver that finished product. My prime directive, as far as I'm concerned, is to just make a great game.
Ooh, prime directive. Are you a fan of Star Trek, Barry?
I have been known to watch some Star Trek.
Good, you can stay.
Doesn't it all depend on what Star Trek he watches?
Shatner. I watch Shatner.
Yeah, that could be a long conversation. Dorian.
Yes.
What type of artwork do you do? Wonder movies, user interface, unit models?
Since I've been here, I've spent a lot of time doing the unit animations. And for Civ, I was Soren's early prototype guy, which meant we had a working version of the game where about 80% of the stuff I had done, I had worked on. So terrain, some interface, unit modeling, and unit animation. But what that means is when you do prototype stuff, all of that gets replaced. So I tend to be someone that's really quick doing assets that other people can do a much better job at. And since I was on Beyond the Sword, what you tend to do as a art lead is you try to make sure that everyone's really comfortable working towards the same direction. So what you do with the units when you're animating, for what I did with Civ 4, you try to make sure that all the animations work well together and they're all really clear and that no one's confused whether or not someone's winning a fight or losing a fight. When you're a lead on a project, it tends to be the same way. But instead of the little units, you're trying to make a staff feel like they're winning the fight and make sure that they know exactly why they're doing what they're doing. One is communicating to the player, and the other is communicating to a team. But it's a lot of communication and making things really clear visually.
Do we have you to thank for the Catherine animation?
No.
Aww.
I may have done an animation that was replaced. No, Catherine was animated by, I think, either Ed Lynch or Dennis, and they did a great job. We scaled that back a little bit. I can't tell you what she was doing earlier. But,
This is a family show, Dorian.
The original cut on her animation had Steve Ogg, who is the lead artist, saying, we need to scale that back a little bit.
But was it? Ask Cold Fever what he thought. He'll tell you what he thought of that animation.
Yeah. And I have to say that Catherine in Civ Revolution is a little bit cuter. Even cuter.
That's right.
Than Civ 4.
Oh, okay. So Catherine got cuter and Cleopatra got hotter. Gotcha.
There's a slight trend, maybe. I don't know. Alexander's all buff. I don't know.
Yeah, and what's Napoleon doing with his hand?
That has never come up. Believe it or not, that's the first time we've ever heard that. Yeah, if you had access to some of our internal emails, that question would be answered. But, I think he's just hiding his hand.
It's indigestion, is what I've been told.
Oh.
Note to self, practice emails over.
Yeah.
One more question for Barry, perhaps. So you were initially a producer, and now you're an executive producer. What's the difference exactly?
More meetings, more management. It's a really weird thing right now because I'm sort of doing two things. I'm an executive producer, but I'm also still producing Civ Revolution, which is probably a slight conflict, but I really enjoy working with Sid. And so this will probably be my last product as just a straight product producer. All the production, all the designers, QA, and the sound guys all report to me. As I said before, I think in one of the other questions, my prime goal here is to make a great game. And at Firaxis, we feel like, or most of us feel, that the only way to make a great game is if everything supports design. Guys can't go off in a vacuum and do their own thing and expect it to work. Everybody has to work together as a team, and we have to try to present stuff in a way that presents the game exactly the way the designer thought it would be presented. I should say, like, you know, it's great that Dorian's here with me right now, because out of all the guys here, nobody is better at figuring out what it is about the art that defines the game and making that work correctly. So now we're going to hug.
We're hugging.
Hey, now, this is a family-friendly
That's enough, Barry, please. That's just supposed to chest hug.
How could it be family-friendly if you were cursing?
Yeah, we stopped being family-friendly some time ago, Dan.
Barry gave me a great compliment, but I think that the main thing is it's not so much that I'm great at figuring it out. I just ask the designers why it is that they want to do something, and I try to make sure that their goals are as clear to the whole team. I mean, it's a nice compliment, but I think that there's at least 10 guys, I know that's Civ 4, I could just say, well, if it hadn't been for this person, the audience would have hated us.
Yeah, I didn't say that the other guys weren't good. I said that sure. Nobody's better.
We're hugging again, and there's an exchange of a 20.
Executive producer at Firaxis is different than being in Hollywood, as in there you get paid, but you don't actually do anything.
Ooh. Send all hate mail.
I have a few friends that do TV stuff, and I think the executive producers for TV are closer to what Barry does than for film. I know that executive producers for film tend to be funding, and they have a very vested interest in making sure that everyone's working together. They're usually working late at night making phone calls between directors and actors. But executive producers for TV have been advanced writers. And so in a certain way, like from what I've seen Barry do, he's sort of like a meta designer. He's not going to get in the way of Sid's design at all. He tries to facilitate it. But whenever Sid isn't as clear, it's up to Barry to make sure that he's clear with the rest of the crew to explain it. And so it's much more the role of an executive writer to some degree or a television producer than it would be a film executive.
For both of you, what was your involvement and role in Beyond the Sword?
I'll go first because for Beyond the Sword, I was more of an advisory role than anything else. You know, since the design guys report to me and since Jesse, the producer, reports to me, I wasn't directly involved in a whole lot of Beyond the Sword stuff other than just keeping abreast of what they were doing and being able to advise on various things, like if they're having localization issues or things like that. I think Dorian's role was much more significant.
Sure. I was the art lead for that, and that meant overseeing a team of about 6 guys for about a year period.
And we did everything from checking out the asset list, the concept art, and implementation. The first thing that we did was supporting the core game with a lot of the added civilizations and some of the added interface features that we needed. And then we went on to try to support the different internal mods that we did. One of the most fun things I did, I wish I could have had more time with, was spending some time giving art direction to the mod community. One of the things we included in Beyond the Sword was the ethnically diverse units. And the idea was if you start as a Middle Eastern civ, there should be something flavored with your early units. And I got a chance to post some art to the forums, the Frankenstein forums, and the turnaround time that the guys gave us was great. And I just wasn't able to support them as much as I wanted because I was also trying to manage the stuff internally and make sure that the interface... I ended up doing buttons, and I had no idea how many buttons were needed for this game. It's completely changed my view of what a game is. Hopefully for the better, but...
That was going to be my question, a follow-up question, for the better.
Yeah. I have a huge respect for the importance of buttons and the kind of information they need to convey at a glance to the beginning player and the sort of experience that you want to have as a experienced player. And I'm really hoping that whatever product I'm on next will have not better buttons, but just a unity to the buttons. I was just amazed at how much time Justin Thomas had spent making the Civ 4 buttons. So, huge props. But anyway, one of the best things was working with the mod community to make the stuff in Beyond the Sword as good as it was.
So I have a follow-up question about the working with the modding community. Is that very different from working with internal artists?
It's surprisingly different, but if the art is good, the results can be very similar. The difference is when you're working with guys here, it's a 9-to-5 job. I don't know any artist that actually worked just 8 hours the last month or so of Beyond the Sword. I mean, they put a lot of time and energy into it. But there's a certain professionalism that it makes you feel a little bit more distant sometimes, which is important when you're working together. The thing I got from working with the mod community is just how passionate they were about what they were doing, and it reminded me a lot of the first year or two that I was making game art. It wasn't that the team here wasn't passionate, but it was just that everything was new. It felt like everything was new, and they had a real love for the game that they were working on. And it made me want to really embrace that with anything that I'm working on in the future. It just seemed like everyone loved the game, 100% that they're working on. We'd have the best game in the world. And the trick is to make sure that the game that we're making is loved by everyone, especially on the team. The passion that they worked with made up for any lack of experience they had in the game industry. That was surprising to me, because when Alex came to me and said, "We're hoping that you work with some artists in the mod community," I had no idea what to expect with quality or anything. I was super impressed. Because they're volunteers, I can't say, "You need to get this done by next week." And internally, you know, sometimes we have to do that. If someone like Barry were to come down and say, "We're worried about this, and you need to make this happen," I have no choice but to either make it happen or to leave my job. Now, the mod community is, some guy could just drop off, and it would really depress the people in the community, but that difference in accountability is important to have sort of in-house.
Well, that's okay, Doran. You could ask. They would just ignore you. Well, I think the next question about any news on a Beyond the Sword patch has since been addressed. The question was made.
I was going to say, you guys are connected to the internet, right?
Is there a patch? What are the plans for the patch, Barry?
I plan to have one out by the time this is...
Okay. Excellent.
Dan gets to work on it really quickly. It's released by tonight.
That's also what producers do. We make it so that other people have to work harder.
Can you tell us if there are plans for future patches beyond this one? Or is it too early for that?
It's too early right now because we want to see... Part of the problem when you're making anything, like if you're trying to release the first version of a game or you're releasing a patch, is you can test something for a year with, you know, 50 testers. And if you sell a decent number of copies in the first 2 days, you'll have more testing done on your game than that entire year. And you'll have it on more types of hardware and people thinking of different things, you know, so... As much as we can test, it's hard to, you really don't know how the game's going to hold up until it gets out there in the public. So we just have to wait and see for right now and see
what comes up, because when you're trying to get something out, you have deadlines, things like that. Sometimes you miss something. You hope that you don't. You do everything you can to try not to leave something bad in there, but sometimes it happens.
This question basically asks, what happened to the two planned Beyond the Sword scenarios, Super Robo and Chaos, and why were they replaced with Fence? Also, will they be included in an upcoming patch?
I think we could probably answer the second one of those questions.
Yeah. The second question has probably already been answered, but I guess this person really wanted to know about the first question, or what happened to them.
Well, they have a similar story, but they get there from a different place. Yeah, what we want to do is we want stuff that's fun. And sometimes you can write something down on paper and you can start developing it, and everything seems fun right up until you get to that really magic time where it's like, okay, I think all the parts are in, and it may or may not hold up at that point. Now, Super Robo was done by a guy named Jesse Crass Finch, who was here as a temporary employee. He had also done Broken Star, and when he left to go to another company, and he left both of those with Liam Collins, who still works here. Basically, we found that Broken Star was a lot easier to get ready for the public than Super Robo. We felt like we just didn't have the parts there, and without the original designer still here to sort of answer questions or to help shepherd it, it just didn't feel like it was worth the effort to keep it going. And so, since Jesse's not here any longer, that means that don't expect to see that one in an upcoming patch. Chaos was done by Ed Piper, and the problem with that one was, I think that it's a fun scenario and it was working out okay. The problem was, is the whole purpose of the scenario was to have a bunch of crazy sort of events that could happen that would really make the game sort of nuts, you know, earthquakes and all these kind of crazy things. As we developed the random event system in the game, and the game started to have more and more cool events, it didn't seem as cool to have this scenario that was all about these events. It had also been developed before the event system, so consequently it wasn't really tied into that system. So it just seemed best at that time to let it go, and so Ed switched gears, and that's when he went and did the defense scenario. Since we have so many good events in the game and you guys have the ability to make more, I think that Chaos will probably remain on the cutting room floor as well.
From an art point of view, when those decisions were made, we always prioritize what sort of needs to get done first in the project. And by deciding that these two weren't necessarily worth the amount of art time to make them a good experience for everyone, it freed up some time to spend on the other areas. It's not like there's a lot on the cutting room floor that would be the representative of what the design idea was. If it was pretty close, we would release it and say, hey, have fun. But the whole point is that we didn't find it as fun.
And welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about various hot topics on all the different forums that talk about Civ.
Which corporation is weakest? Well, amazingly, there's zero votes for Sid Sushi, which we called the strongest in a prior podcast.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And Mining Inc. too.
Mining Inc., yes. I think we made some good choices.
Either that or we're just as delusional as they are.
That may be true. So Civilized Jewelers and Standard Ethanol are winning out at the moment.
Yeah, Civilized Jewelers is the one that gives culture, I think. That's got to be pretty useless. You don't really need culture that late in the game. Unless you're going for a culture victory, but there are better ways to get more culture. So yeah, I have to go with that one.
And then, of course, you have the standard replies that all corporations are useless.
Civilized Jewelers has an okay name. Actually, probably the second best name on there, but that's all it's got going for it.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of like the name Cereal Mills.
Yeah. Well, Sid Sushi is kind of funny, I guess. Those are two good names. The other ones are just kind of lame.
Yeah, Aluminum Inc. is kind of okay.
Yeah.
Well, Creative Constructions, that has alliteration going for it.
That's true. Well, Standard Ethanol is an interesting play on Standard Oil, so.
Yeah.
There's a comment here about Standard Ethanol that says it clashes with the best corporations, the food ones, and practically useless if you have oil. If you had oil, why would you build it?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't have oil, it's extremely useful, so it's situational, I guess.
Yeah, it goes on to say, if you don't have oil, you have to be seriously desperate, not only to pay corporation-grade maintenance for it, but to lose a more powerful corpse in order to get it. Not if you'd be having living hell bombed out of you, you wouldn't. just the point of it to replace oil.
Yep.
Does anyone here actually use corporations as a general rule?
Don't you have to get that far in the game first?
Yeah.
Okay, Imran, you can just go to sleep for this conversation then.
Oh, well, I get to go to sleep too.
Yeah, I don't all that often come this far in the game either. But when I do, yeah, I usually found one or two of them. Especially the food one can be useful.
I usually go for state property, it's other benefits, so that kind of rules corporations out, but that's okay. Most worthless unit.
Currency makes a good point. Stealth bombers get shot down too often. And isn't that the whole point about being stealth?
I think I'm more inclined to go with Bonafide 11 about the Grenadier.
Yeah, I guess when Beyond the Sword introduces new units, some of the older, strong units get a bit, passed aside because of the new ones.
Oh, explorers.
True, by the time you get them, you're done exploring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, there's actually 8 pages on this over at CFC.
Good grief. Were they bored?
No, that's not the most worthless unit. Yes, it is. So on the last page, someone talks about how he likes explorers. So there you go.
Valada says they've never been a big fan of the machine gun. Oh, I think it can have its uses.
That's not that bad.
Goes without saying ironclads. We've talked about that before.
Yeah, those are...
Yeah.
Someone says they like ironclads. Let's make fun of them.
Ha ha ha. Uh-huh.
Insert generic mocking here.
Shu Nakamura. Okay, it is slow as molasses, however. That's being generous. And careful placement and the right promotions, proving the world is round, can offset that, though. No, I don't think so.
No.
From Escipiter Q saying, what the heck is wrong with peace treaties in this game? I've been playing all along, and then a sudden notification will pop up that my peace treaty with the Civ has just expired, but I've never been at war with them ever. Yeah, I just ignore that. As the G says, a new feature in BTS, Beyond the Sword, for anyone who's listening who doesn't know, is that any deal with an enemy civ, whether it's a trade, a demand, or a gift, automatically makes an unbreakable peace for 10 turns. This is to reduce backstabbing, I guess.
Backstabbing.
In the darkness of the night.
Part 2 of our interview with Firaxis Games is Barry Caudill and Dorian Newcomb.
We're doing the Civ Rev questions, and the art lead on that is Brian Busati, and I'm sure that he would have volunteered his time here except for the fact that his life is dominated by Civilization Revolution.
Understandable.
For those who have been living under a rock out there, what is Civ Rev? What platforms are you developing for, and when is it due to come out?
We wanted to try to bring Civilization to a new market. Felt like we've done a lot with the PC version, and the PC version has done really well for us. But as you get farther and farther into something, you make a 1, 2, 3, 4, it has this tendency to start to get more and more complex. So the problem is that if somebody has never played Civilization before and they want to just sort of jump in, if they were to just sit down in front of Civ 4, it's a little daunting. So we wanted to sort of readdress it and find a way to maybe attract new people into Civ, and we thought the easiest way to make a clean break would be to go to the console market and take advantage of some of the cool consoles, because we all play console games. And so that's what we're trying to do. We try to streamline the game, make it a little more focused, really up the presentation factor. And it's coming out for the Xbox 360, the PS3, and the DS in the spring. And then it'll come out for the Wii in the fall.
So there's no PSP version planned?
There isn't. The primary reason for that is that all of those versions that I listed are being done in-house. And we just don't have the people right now to do anything for PSP. It's possible that something could happen in the future, but we just don't have the people available.
Now, what is your involvement in Civilization Revolution?
My involvement is, even though I'm the executive producer, I work as the producer for that title. And Dorian is involved because he comes to the part of our sort of overall design team here, and so he comes to the meetings and helps pitch in ideas and stuff like that.
I also had a chance to do some really early concept designs for Revolution. So certain things were ideas that we had, and I would make little animations to show them off. Curved world look was something that I was asked to do, and I'm thrilled that it's in the game now. Because it's one of those things where I show off something a little bit fancy and tricky, and everyone, the programmers, work really hard to make that a reality. So it's been really fun only spending a few months on something and seeing the kind of impact that has long term.
On a follow-up for Dorian, what is more fun to design as an artist? The more realistic-ish looking graphic of Civ 4, the more kind of cartoonish, over-the-top look of Civ Rev?
For animators, it's always fun to go a little bit bigger. So I think, you know, as far as the units for Civ 4 went and some of the leaderhead stuff, we pulled back and it was animated. It was clearly had an animated style, but everything needed to be very quick and we didn't go too far into the real expressive realm of animation. And the animation work I've seen from Revolution has just been beautiful. The leader characters and the way that they move and the unit animations are really crisp and alive. So I think sometimes it can be really fun, really push yourself in that direction. But normally I think it's most rewarding if you just have a clear direction to go. So if you know that you're going realistic, if you can really embrace that and the entire aesthetic can go in that direction, you can get an entire team fired up and I can be excited doing that. And the same is true with cartoony. The problems occur usually when the style isn't as clear as you'd like. Most artists just want to make one thing that looks beautiful from every angle. But I think it's been fresh for the studio to have this very alive, very vivid world come to life. Because I know that we all wanted a very vivid living world in Civ 4, but I think Revolution sort of took it to the next level.
So what are the differences between developing for the PC and developing for a console? What are the limitations and benefits of a console game compared to PCs?
I think the primary benefit is the fact that it's sort of a closed architecture system. You know, one of the beauties of PCs, you know, you can have all different levels of PC. You can put in different video cards, different amounts of memory, all that kind of stuff. But as a developer, it's a nightmare because everybody thinks that their machine is great. But sometimes you look at the DX Diag and you're like, oh, geez, that's a three-year-old video card. It's not really that great. So when you have these set-top boxes, you can really take advantage of everything they have to offer because you know that everyone that has a PS3, everyone that has an Xbox 360 is going to see the game exactly the same way. So you can take full advantage of the expected hardware. The downside is based on the same thing though. Because it is a set-top box, you do have limited memory. And so like the 360, you know, you have about 512 to work with, you know, probably less than that once you have all the system stuff going. And on a computer, you know, if you run out of memory, it'll start thrashing the hard drive, but at least it'll keep on going. With a console, if you run out of memory, you're dead. PS3 is even a little tougher because the memory is split up a little bit more. So I think the primary benefit is just that we can really assume that the least common denominator is the top-end machine, but it's also our biggest limitation is that that's as good as it gets.
From the art point of view, working on a console, you really have the opportunity to present players with a lot of information because screen resolutions are so high now. Even with the HD setups that the new consoles have, you still are much more limited. So I think from an art point of view, we are constantly trying to make it so that people can see instead of read. And it's that balance of text on the screen and graphical information. It's sort of like trying to change our habits because we've expected such a high resolution for all the PC things. It's really hard to make it just really simple and pure on the consoles.
So in sort of a related tangent, is there going to be much of other differences in the gameplay between the different console versions? And are you going to put in exclusive things like as with other games?
Yeah, there's definitely going to be some differences. I mean, at some point, unless you have a whole lot of time, you have to be able to make one game and, you know, that works on both platforms. But we are working with both Microsoft and Sony to discover areas where we can be a little bit different. With Microsoft, you have the live stuff, which is great, already plugged up, you know, multiplayer system, and you can work right in that. Everything is there for you. But on the PS3, we're also working with GameSpy. We're going to have all the same stuff, the leaderboards and the ladders and stuff like that. The 360 has achievements. That's like money right now. I mean, people will rent games or buy games just to get more achievement points. So we're really taking advantage of that stuff. PS3's got home, but we're still in the process of working with them to figure out what that's going to be and whether we're going to be able to take advantage of it because it still hasn't really come out yet. One of the things on the PS3 we can also sort of take advantage of is the fact that there's way more storage on a Blu-ray than there is on the DVDs that the Xbox uses. The DS, of course, is a completely different ballgame, and the Wii will be a completely different ballgame as well. The beauty is that we have the same game core running on all systems. So the gameplay, the core gameplay will actually be the same. It's going to be the presentation that changes around the game core. But the DS we've been playing a lot recently, and it's darn fun.
Yeah, personally, as much as I love the art on the 360, I've been playing a lot more of the DS, just because that's where I tend to play strategy games right now. It just seems like there's a few more. I can sit in bed and play Civ, which is awesome. I don't know. I just think that's going to be a great experience. And one of the things that motivated us to make a portable game to begin with was the idea of we're all flying out to GDC, and we're all like, I wish we could play Civ together. That'd be awesome. And we're like, well, what system do you have? What system do you have? Well, let's do it. And everyone looked at us like a little bit crazy. They're like, you want to do what?
A little bit?
How will the epic feeling of the PC-based Civ be maintained in the console version? And so how will you keep the Civ-ness of the game?
Well, that's easy, because Sid Meier made Civilization 1, and Sid Meier's doing Civilization Revolution. So I think if anybody understands what the Civ-ness is of Civilization, it's probably the guy who created it. I can say, like, all of the stuff that's in there. You know, I mean, you still build cities, you still make armies, you still make decisions about what to research, you still make decisions about whether you should go cultural or economic or military or things like that. There's a lot of the decisions, what we feel are the really key decisions to Civilization, are there. We probably don't have a lot of the real advanced stuff that we've put in the last couple versions of Civ. We didn't feel like it was worth it to put in religions or things like that. You know, maybe that could come later, maybe not. But we feel like the basic Civ-ness of the game is definitely there.
And one thing, I mean, having worked with Sid in the past, and I think having played a lot of Civ, it's the idea of making a series of decisions and constantly waiting to see those decisions pay off. As a Civ player, that's what excites me. I set up a whole bunch of things. I'm going to build a city here. I'm going to try to get this resource. I'm moving an army over here. I need to keep the peace with this player until I really want to take their land. And all of those elements are in. It's just presented in a different layer, and the pacing is a little bit different.
So how will the unique abilities of each Civ work? We've seen that they can be quite powerful. Any examples?
Sure. The one thing that we're really trying to do that's, you know, Sid had a great idea that's been a lot of fun, is that each Civ gets special abilities, but then the special abilities stack up throughout the eras. One of the things that we did to make sure that the game was accessible and easy to understand is that each tile in the game only gives you one thing. There's no, like, grassland with a shield where it gives you both food and production. So normally water squares give you trade. Well, for the Japanese, they start off and they actually get food. So obviously they'll gravitate towards coastal towns right away. You know, other civs will have things like extra movement. The Africans get extra movement early. So they have, like, the Impi warriors are moving a lot quicker than your guys. You remember some?
Oh, my goodness. I am not as familiar with these. There's one programmer here named Jake, and every week he comes and he's like, dude, you need to cut this down. This dominates. You know, I was playing the Russians, and this bonus I got here just destroyed everyone. And the next week he tries out another Civ. So I haven't kept track of what his latest and greatest Civ is, but they balance each other because they're very strong in one direction, usually only.
Right. Right. Well, the Aztecs, I was just playing the Aztecs on the DS version, and they start off with the ability to heal in combat. Normally, unless you have the medic upgrade for your unit has to go back to the city to heal. They can't heal anywhere else, but the Aztecs will heal wherever they are. It's a really cool thing because it just means that you can get out there and you can really push the battle, especially early. When you're fighting a lot of barbarians and stuff like that, you can just get out there and do things. The Egyptians actually get extra trade from desert squares, so that, of course, they'll settle in the desert.
Closer to a desert than most people would.
Right. So it makes it kind of fun. With Civ 4, you know, we're really, really trying to make a game that's incredibly balanced. And with Civ Revolution, we're getting that balance in a completely different way because Sid likes the idea that if you can make a connection, if you say, well, if I have this Civ and I settle here and then I get this great person and he lives in this city and then I build this building, then I'm going to make like some ridiculous amount of science per turn. And he thinks that that's great if you put everything together and you should feel smart. You should get rewarded for that. That's just kind of the way that we go with this game. We want it to be sort of not capped for people. I think I answered like four questions at once there.
I think we're not going to bring back Civ 3's corruption. I think that's the bottom line.
Yeah, that would be good.
How about pollution?
No, not a chance.
Africans? Does that mean there's going to be a generic African cis, a lot of generic Native Americans? I can already hear the rants stress being started.
Trying to think. One of the funny things, I think that's a reference to the Beyond the Sword Native Americans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It. You know, it's sort of funny because from my side of things, we really wanted to have a Native American civ in the game. And we would have preferred to have a specific tribe with a specific leader. And sometimes you go into these design meetings and you end up making these compromises and you don't necessarily understand what the fallout is. You know, we definitely wanted some representative that you could play in North America, even though history is the way it is. But the other thing is sometimes it works the other way. Like in around March or April, I kept hearing this rumor that we were going to have ninjas in the game. And I said, hey, we're not going to have ninjas in the game. But when it came time to make the ancient spy, I had decided to make everyone's worst fears come true. And so the great spy in the ancient era is a ninja. And all of that was brought about because I would have never thought about it, but everyone's so worried about it. We delivered the goods. So it's a, you know, it's a two-way street. We really want to respect history. We really want to provide a diverse experience for people. And sometimes we don't step as gingerly as we should. But I don't think I've seen anything quite as sort of gut-wrenching, historian-buff, bile-building as the Native American civ. Sorry.
Yeah. If anything, probably because almost everybody that's here is from the United States or North America, and so I think that there's that tendency to, we study all that stuff. You know, we studied Native Americans, you know, or so consequently, when it comes up, we're just like, oh, yeah, that's got to be in the game. And maybe someone from Europe or Asia is like, what? Why would that be in there? Yeah. So
I'm part Mohawk. I'm sensitive in the sense of with that knowledge, but I'm not sensitive in the sense of having that experience. I just feel like I'm an American at this point. But I know that my great-grandfather ran away from a reservation and sort of had to build his own life. And so the idea is, what impact does that have when you have a game about civilizations and you sort of say, well, let's not show any of this people group because they didn't have writing. We want to have the Sumerians because they were the first, or, you know, one of the first. We should, you know, have something that represents them. But what about the people that didn't quite have the commerce and the trade from the Middle East touching their lives? What do we do for them?
We got voicemail.
G'day, it's Mike Lucas Smith here. Been listening to your podcast for a while now. Hey, I was playing a multiplayer game of Civ 4 the other day, and I saw some guy was chatting, putting in icons from the game, little lightning bolts for the power, etc., into his chat messages. How did you do that? Bye.
It's true that Solver did answer the question for us. He just wants to be on the show again, that's all.
I find that hard to believe.
Yes, you really can show icons like that. To do it, you type, for example, icon underscore food or icon underscore power. You need to type it in all caps and you need to enclose it in square brackets.
What a helpful answer.
Now we all must run out and try it.
Would it be bad if I meant to be like, what? Icons? Chat? What the hell?
We just assumed that was the default position there, Emery. You didn't need to tell us.
Civ?
But to append to Solver's answer, there's actually quite a long list of these commands. It's not really ideal to list them all here, so I'll post them in the forums once this episode is posted. So check out our Politon community forum at politon.net/forums, and you'll find a full list there.
What a nice guy.
Who, me?
Yeah, I'm confused. Some other person.
That can't be right. Call in today.
301-637-659. 301-637-POLY.
44-020-7871-7659. 44-020-7871-POLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
Log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Here's a trip, One Track Mind.
Uh-oh. Girls who play Civ? Girls playing Civ?
Oh, the threat is about Hot Seat. Who really cares?
Send all hate mail. Oh, who am I kidding? No one plays.
Now you have enough material for two polycasts again.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, cool. Barry, are you offended by cursing? Because I feel the need to do that right now.
If I was offended by cursing, I wouldn't be in the game industry.
Being on polycast is not quite like listening to it. I'm sure John warned you.
He gave me a little bit of a warning, yes.
What are you, crazy? You're going on that show after all I've told you?
Record date September 15th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV Warlords and Beyond the Sword. Copyright 2007, Apolton Civilization site at apolton.net.